to that list?
Yeah.
Membership in the Citizens Advisory Council. Now, Paul, you knew I was going to do that at some point.
There are only two.
We'll go through the rest.
Yeah, is there
one? Is there one in, I don't know if there's one in the Aleutians.
One in.
Well, there are, yeah, there are ways to and this, I don't know if you want to go in that discussion, but the two current ones could extend activities down the southeast and down the southwest. I mean, if poor Captain Upmacher has to do that. but, you know, I'm not saying there shouldn't be others. They may, should be others. And, of course, that has to be established at some point in time. But certainly, after 10 years of operations in Cook Inlet for the 220-mile stretch there, why, I think our group has a lot to offer in that regard. And I can get into a lot of details at some point in time.
Okay, let's just maybe put it this way then, since we're not going to be a voting committee. Is there anybody here on our committee that believes that we ought to continue to be promoting mandatory measures? Does anybody want to speak in favor of mandatory measures? I haven't heard anybody do that yet. I want to give everybody a chance to do that since we're supposed to operate on consensus. Or anyone here who wants to speak in favor of mandatory? Captain O'Hara.
Before we abandon mandatory, I think I would like to understand credit first. I don't understand this concept of credit and how it applies to financial finances. I think that is a question of the Chidot and that group, whether or not they would use the idea of credits, accept the idea of credits. And I think that's what the crux is.
Okay, well, when we get into that, that's one issue, is the response planning standard and how Chidot might interpret that in terms of their cost structure. But there's some other possible things maybe having to do with insurance or even, you know, state corporate income tax or what? I don't know. I mean, there may be other ideas out there for how to do it. COFR? Heather?
Regulatory relief.
Yeah, Heather McCarty. I was going to ask the Coast Guard representative if, or anybody else, if they knew whether there were any financial credits, like we're talking about here, given for these standards of care that are in the federal
establishment. I don't know John Bingaman with the Coast Guard, our five-star voluntary uninspected passenger vessel program. We have talked with several insurance companies, and they have expressed an interest in the program and possibly reducing insurance rates for those. I think it's similar in the insurance field, is you charge those that present higher risks with higher premiums and those with lower risks, lower premiums. It's not a financial incentive from the federal government perspective. But as far as their own business costs, there may be some incentives through insurance cost reduction.
Could you give us just a little more detail on that? Because this is something that we've struggled with here, and I do think that these insurance companies are the ones that really do save money, clearly. If you've got prevention measures on board, if you've got this required response contractor and the other things that are in this bill, these are the guys that are going to stick the money into their pocket in avoided costs that they would have under insurance. But yet it's not reflected back in the insurance premiums. So are you saying that there is it you have been talking with the insurance companies, or there is some program that's been instituted that reflected this?
John Bingaman again. We've spoken with the insurance companies, and they've expressed an interest in the program and learning more what it is that we're requiring in order to achieve a five-star rating. As if that has resulted in an actual cost savings to an individual operator, I do not know.
Captain Hutmacher, you had something more?
I was just going to mention that, right on the larger vessel scale, we're talking protection and indemnity clubs, hull underwriters. But we are not aware that anything at this point this point is, even with all the various prevention measures that have been instituted, these are the result of our actions or even voluntary actions, that that's necessarily equated to a reduction in rates. It'd be nice if it did. I don't know that it has.
John Bingaman again. It might be a good question to ask the two co-ops what they may or may not do with if a vessel meets all the recommended measures that you list. How would they do anything with that? I think they would. Yeah, it doesn't reduce their costs, but.
You're
I don't know.
About the
I'm
response,
not the expert. To
the response contractors.
The prevention credits issue is actually the next one on the agenda. I'm not sure if we want to stray from the discussion or if a group does want to jump forward to that and then jump back again to go over what the measures are.
Because what you're saying, Captain O'Hara, is that if there's no way we can implement a credit, then you want to go back and look at mandatory issues?
I'm not saying that. I just don't think I'm ready to I would like to understand the prevention credit business.
Well, if we decide not to recommend mandatory prevention measures and we go with a system of optional or recommended, we would be doing that for one reason, clearly, in order to establish some sort of credit setup, right? And so I think the two are very linked. So
yeah.
We need to talk about the possibility of credits before we can go any further, I think.
Jeff, and then
I just have a quick anecdotal comment, and it sort of gives a different psychology to the idea of credit, and that is, when faced with a halibut charter choice out to the Barren Islands for Homer, I've got a choice between a 5-star operator and a 2-star. For the same, I mean, obviously the 5-star program that Coast Guard has been doing has been very effective to those operators that are willing to get the 5 stars in terms of their overall business. Now, granted, that's limited strictly to the charter boat industry for sport fishing, but the same sort of idea is that the better operators, there's going to be, it's hard for us to identify the relationships and the commercial applications financially exactly, but I think it really is incumbent upon us as a work group here to really work on this credit situation. True, the other three Western states have not had a lot of success, to my knowledge, with working through prevention credits. I think we have a real opportunity here, and I would rather, invest our time in really looking at this hard and seeing what we can come up with.
Okay, Susan, and then Larry, unless you want to defer to you.
Go ahead, Susan.
No, I can tell you. You already had your
right. Yeah,
you said, and I will have
Go ahead, Susan.
Oh, excuse me, hurry to be. Prevention-wise, I guess a few thoughts here. In terms of mandatory, it seems like we got a little bit more homework to do to really figure out the gap analysis. We have tried to unravel the complex federal regulations, as I'm sure you all have, and tried to sort out what's required for each of these classes of vessels to see what incremental piece the state might want to prevention measures. I feel like there's still a little bit of homework here that the Coast Guard could clearly help us on to identify that. And my gut reaction is to the work that we've done so far is that for the larger classes of vessels, for example, the 1,600 gross ton and above, they already have a long laundry list and probably are pretty comprehensively covered. As you head towards the 400, it seems as though it's tapered off and that there may be some prevention measures we might want to consider looking at bigger lists that we might want to make mandatory or optional or recommended, I'm not sure, but I still think we need to do that gap analysis to thoroughly understand, because as you go down the smaller vessels, you'll see.
If your department can't do it, you want the task force to do it.
Well, I guess what I'm suggesting, that's a fair comment back, I'm suggesting that the Coast Guard could maybe help us provide some of that data as an input to the group. We have tried to unravel it a bit. In terms of the prevention, another suggestion is there are some items, as we mentioned, that are going to be done on the response side, and there may be some things that we might run put them in the hubs where everybody can invest and share in the availability of the resources. So that might be something we want to think about as to whether or not mandatory prevention measures are something that we could, whether it requires them to be individual vessel operators or whether it's something that could be at a hub center location that could be accessible to a wide group of folks. As part of the equipment inventory, make it more cost effective for the smaller operators, which are going to be tending to be, as I'm envisioning, the ones that are going to need that incremental boost on the prevention end.
Larry?
Yeah, well, just in terms of, I think, what the task force is supposed to do here, I guess my take on it would, I'm not sure the task force was has a wherewithal or was necessarily asked to do what really is a pretty complex, sophisticated analysis. If you're going to look at all of the federal and international laws, sort it out, identify what we like, what we don't like. I think, I don't know, my take on it is that they wanted to see if the task force was making up of the operators working in the state, if there were some fairly simplistic things that made sense to have in Alaska that were affordable and doable without getting into pump specifications and stuff, you know, that we could agree on, you know, can we put them on a list of recommended measures or not? So, yeah, this could get to be quite a chore. I think that's something behind what Eric is saying here. I mean, this is a fairly humongous task here if we don't narrow down what it is we can get done with the resources we got. And to me, it is a more simplistic, you know, is it possible, is it feasible, are the weaknesses because of Alaska waters here, are there some holes, and are some things that we can put on the list without getting down to detailed specifications that would be a goal or a target for non-tank vessels to shoot for? And can we create an incentive or credit to make it attractive?
We've got 5 minutes till lunch. Captain O'Hara.
I have a question of Scott and Charlotte and Jeff regarding the chartering of ships. You folks are on the spot market. You use an outside vendor, somebody in Seattle or something, who actually charters the ship. You just said, give me a ship. Are these folks able to charter, for example, a 5-star ship or a 4-star ship if there were recommendations for the state that the minimum star ship is 3 stars?
Over. I'm not a realtor because I've never been that closely tied to how we get our ships, but perhaps at times you have that ability, and at other times you're doing something very short notice on ships that are already at sea that are being redirected to you because they're available. And it's not something you can always necessarily plan out that carefully. And if it's somebody that's already en route someplace else and gets redirected to you, they're not necessarily going to have that equipment on board. It's not practical to have mandatory equipment on board.
No, I'm saying if we make this all recommended, and certain criteria meet 1-star, 2-star, 3-star, 4-star, 5-star. And the state says, okay, in winter in Cook Inlet, you will have a 3-star ship. In summer in Naknek, you can have a 1-star ship. In, you know, whatever, wherever. It seems to me that that kind of criteria would be using the recommended list and giving the operators the option of a 3-, 4-, 5-star ship in Cook Inlet in winter. I don't know. I mean, that's just a question.
I don't think we have the flexibility.
This is Scott Carter. We, with our business, with our sales and marketing, it is not possible. I can equate it back to something probably easier to understand. You go into the store one day and you buy whatever groceries you need and you go to your car. The checker's there to take you out there or to take your bags to the car for you. We have the similar thing on a large scale. We don't know in advance who our customer's going to be. We've been in for charters on or for sales internationally. We don't know if we're going to be awarded those sales or not. When we are awarded, they have certain commitments as time for deliveries that our chartering group is tasked with trying to get a ship that can deliver in those conditions. So,
Tesoro told me four weeks ago that they were going to have a ship to Palm Orchid in Kiski on October 15th. It's a TK ship. It's top of the line. They knew it, you know, plenty of time to get that ship in order. You must have an inventory control, you know, when you're going to ship and when you're not going to ship, and you have certain favorable lists, because I see many of the gas ships are still the same. You know, the Gas Gloria always comes back, and et cetera.
We do have our ammonia ships are vastly different, actually, than our urea ships. We are on contract with a couple of customers to supply the ammonia. So we pretty much know a schedule of when those ships are going to be there, and actually have the capability of doing a time charter in lieu of a spot charter. That's not always the case, though.
First Charlotte, and then Jeff, since the question was addressed to you, and then we're going to lunch.
Hey, we're out to, I don't know all the details, but you know, we do about 14 ships within our very short season, which is about middle of July, maybe into October. Most of it within about a two-month period. So your flexibility in using 14 five-star ships to fit right in that particular time period that basically is there. It's probably not great. And I think also there's potential circumstances where we may end up, we have a lot of weather problems this year. At one point, we had four ships lined up waiting to be loaded. Whether or not they might choose to redirect one of those ships, to redirect a different ship to us, to make a better, take better advantage of the situation than to wait out there for a couple of weeks, could happen. And those are the things that we don't necessarily have the capability to seek out.
Yeah.
Mike, I was just going to speak in the generalities of what is known as international ship brokerage. When someone needs a ship, you're talking to a broker who makes the arrangements to find a ship for you. And I know in talking with Captain Plummer of Tesoro that they have increased their vetting capabilities from their brokerage side considerably to avoid problems. The driving force of this, to a large degree, has been the Port State Control Program of the Coast Guard. It's conceivable that should Alaska have a list of recommendations that come out sort of as Alaska-friendly, that brokers, international brokers, will very quickly understand what those are and can very quickly, on a recommended basis, say, well, there's an Alaska-friendly, this one's a five-star, for example, vessel that's available, as they have the cognizance, as they have with the Port State Control Program. Once you promulgate your recommendations, it'll then become known very quickly in the international markets of chartering ships, brokering ships, the P&I clubs, as to what those are and what it means in terms of the bottom line. So it's a matter of, I think, of coming up with recommendations, of having some a credit system that works with those recommendations, and then the commercial marketplace will adopt those and understand what they are and can, operate thereof.
So the concept of having Alaska having a rating system is not out of line.
I don't think so.
And issuing this is what you have to have a certain rating. And
again, it has to be incentive based. There has to be something to drive that. The fact that a ship coming in and it's detained immediately by the Coast Guard is a very driving factor to a chartering thing.
Right.
Well, don't send that thing in there because it's going to get, it's not going to make the Coast Guard inspection.
Right.
And I see as a subset of that, possibly the Alaska friendly, for example, set of recommendations could be adopted in the same way, that this is just a better way of doing business and therefore translates to the bottom line.
We'll care to take a lunch break, and when we come back, we'll start out by going through all these provisions and see if you like the way they're stated or whatever, the friendly provisions. And then we'll get into actual prevention trends. Brian's put a few up on the board here. But we can be back at 5 after 1. Let's be back at 10 after 1. We'll crank this up, try to get out of here at a reasonable hour.
If we can get everybody to the table. Once again, I'd like to remind everyone that ask you to identify yourself as you speak, so that the folks online can know who it is that's speaking, and so that Judy can make sure our summary of the meeting is representing the right individuals. And we were on the issue of prevention credits and ready to move back up to the preliminary list of recommended and optional state prevention measures. Paul?
Thanks, Brian. And I do want to recognize that Simon Leszczewski has joined us here from BP Shipping. I think we also, Mr. Doherty from the Coast Guard has joined us. And, well, we'll deal later with whether we're going to do mandatory or optional after we go through credits. That's what everybody wanted to do. But now let's go down through these list of items here and see which of those we want to recommend as measures which would could contribute to the prevention of a marine casualty involving an oil spill. I think that's the criteria that we need to use for these. So we're just starting out with mandatory under one under mandatory measure.
Now attending.
Ketchikan, Ohio.
Welcome. Okay, we're going down through the list of potential measures.
Can I find out who's at the Ketchikan, Ohio?
There's actually no one here yet. Paul and Dave are not back yet, but I just thought I'd dial in so that it was ready when they did show back up, okay?
Okay, we discussed this tow line. Is there any disagreement that that could be a prevention measure? I think that's pretty standard. That's a good one. Now,
what was the question raised earlier as to whether that needs to be tow line and deployment system?
Tow line and deployment.
Well, yeah, by definition, a tow line has to be deployed. You've got to be able to deploy it as opposed to a spare mooring line. So
you'd have to deploy a mooring line, too.
Yeah, there's other things you can do with a mooring line. You just drag it over the stern and let it out 600 feet, and the towboat would have to somehow get it up. But a tow line actually means that you've got to be able to deploy it. So,
are we saying it's semantics, whether we specify tow line or mooring line? Or?
It's more than semantics.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is we just should decide which one we want. Is that right? Okay.
Or say dedicated tow line or mooring line and deployment system.
Say something like that.
Yeah. Dedicated means it's going to be something maintained. It's not something you use to tie the ship up. And then
emergency.
Emergency tow line.
Emergency
tow line. I think it's a...
Okay. Anything more on tow lines? Okay, pumps. I just drafted this in this way. Do we need to change the way that that's stated?
May want to consider what John Bingham with the Coast Guard may want to consider what type of pump you're interested in having, or types of pumps you're interested in having.
The old pump.
I think
the way you put it, that, you know, preventing products on board, I mean, that
and it tells
it covers
you
it pretty well,
it's
yeah.
Be.
Somebody mentioned earlier, do we have to talk about how much it can pump or how fast it can pump, or is that a bicycle pump?
Larry?
Yeah, I just think, I mean, if we're again, I don't think we got the wherewithal to get down the specifications and whatnot just for the pump. So I think the wording on these things are going to end up like, you know, a capability to have line bail, keep vessel off or a rock in an emergency situation or something like that. For the tow capability, the tow wire. And for a pump, it would be pumps on board sufficient to control flooding. And there are two types of pump sources that we've talked about in the past. There's pumps to control flooding, there's pumps for fuel transfer, and the pumps to control flooding are to prevent the casualty, and the pumps to transfer fuel are to reduce the volume of oil that could be spilled. So these things would have to be pretty broadly worded, because each vessel is going to have to determine the specifications. And in some cases, one vessel could do it, and it may not be appropriate at all for another. So they'll have to be broad, in my mind.
thing I'd add to what Larry's saying, too, is that with respect to bilge pumps or the ability to pump out certain spaces, I think these ships, through SOLAS and other requirements, they already have to have that. They have to have that means. They have dedicated bilge pumps, bilge manifolds that go to the different compartments. They already have that. So I think either with respect to that, you're talking about something over and above what's already required, a separate dedicated emergency bilge pump or something like that. And then you also have the one where I think the way it's worded is to handle something, to handle the petroleum products and more. And again, it's more of an emergency type thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question is, was this like a portable pump? I mean,
could you identify yourself when you speak, Simon? So
sorry, my apologies. Yeah. Simon Leshefsky from BP. I guess the question was that are we asking them for a portable, like an emergency pump that you can move to a certain tank? Is that what we're looking for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, move it within the vessel or pump to another vessel alongside. I think maybe we should break it down. We should say water and fuel because it is a prevention measure, a dewatering pump, because if the vessel sinks, you're for sure going to have an oil spill. I mean, even if you don't run it on the rocks, it's going to continue to leak oil for a long time if it goes down. But do people agree with that, water and fuel? We'd say either one of those would qualify.
Well, back to the reason that the Coast Guard has to drop pumps is because the power on the ship is gone.
Right.
The engine room's flooded. So when you start, then you start getting down to pumps that operate on some power other than the ship's power. You know, I don't know if...
But that's assuming there isn't any power.
That's assuming, yeah.
Maybe what we do on first pass is just create the list. And then maybe later on, we go back and try to do the wordsmithing.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's fine. But as we go through, I'm taking notes here, too, because as I redraft this, I'll do the best that I can. We'll get one more shot at this.
Charlotte?
Well, one possibility, too, is if this is being done for credit, you could have stages of how much credit you get. So if you have a small pump, you get small credit. If you've got five pumps, you get, you know, more credit. And then you leave it kind of open so there's credit that can be within this range for pumps and depending on what you have, how much credit you get.
Scott?
Yeah, I guess
just
another point to think about that program plan. Got a place to pump it to. Having a pump is going to do you a lot of good, so are we putting like portable bladder systems, or is it not knowing what the fuel condition is going to be when you get here, the faster tanks, ballasting conditions?
I think the assumption that the other group has been that storage capacity is part of the response, I think, and something that there was a lot of focus on there. So it may be that the issue of storage and where you're pumping to is taken care of in the response rather than in the prevention.
If you were to provide, could that be another optional component that you were going to provide some sort of storage capacity on the ship? And separate, not kind of pumps are one thing and someone else may bring the ladder, or you may want to supply your own prevention.
But then would you count empty spaces on the ship as potential places to store oil?
Dedicated.
Yeah, I think, Larry Dietrich, I think in an emergency situation, there would be other spaces that you would count that you might, that would not be dedicated that you might use in an emergency situation.
Just
a plan in that case of, it's an improvement. I mean, if you only put it into official and the crew trained that way and that keeps it well on water, I mean, there's both internal space management and then there's external storage that can be brought to the scene, which is what Paul was mentioning. So, but either one of those can potentially reduce the volume of the discharge, which could be a benefit.
Maybe we could
the only place on a ship, the only place I can think of is you have enough spare capacity being fresh water tanks. And if you hold a ship and then pump out a double bottom, put that water in a, put that oil into a fresh water tank after you pump out the fresh water, basically the ship's, that's the end of the ship. You can't operate without fresh water. Pump it into a cargo hold? I don't know how you would freeze
the ship. Stability concerns, you know, is that if you started pumping large quantities, I mean, I think that will be a real problem.
Right.
If you want to pump this stuff, you want to pump it somewhere out of the ship or, you know, to some other storage, I think.
Bill Huttmacher, I think the big thing here, you know, you want to have an emergency capability that is suitable or capable of moving the petroleum products that you're carrying on that vessel, i.e., if you're a ship that operates on intermediate fuel oil or number six oil, that it has to be something on an emergency basis that's capable of pumping that. And then if you're operating a 400 gross ton fishing vessel, fish processor, something like that, and you're operating on marine diesel, then you can have a completely different type of emergency pump because that's capable of moving that cargo. I think that's the key, is it's got to be, the way you have it worded, Paul, is not, I think is pretty good. Pumping the prevailing or the, you know, it's suitable or capable of pumping the petroleum products that are on board. That's the key.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can get in other issues. You can get into whether or not you have a space to pump it. Larry brought up the factor that this is done all the time with smaller vessels that are grounded, especially fishing vessels. We want to stop. We don't want to have the pollution. They use the fish hold. They pump it right into it. Because the key is just keeping it from getting into the environment, and then they can clean it out and get it ready for the fish again. But the key is having a pump that you can actually move around somewhere and using a sounding tube or a vent or whatever, pump it out. But you certainly couldn't use a diesel-type pump on an IFO product. It's not going to happen. It's not going to work. I think your wording is right.
That's fine, because we're going to come back and prioritize these things and give values, and we can sort of take these kinds of things into judgments into account as we go.
Okay, moving down the list then to the second number one, non-contiguous tank location on the vessel. Put it this way rather than double hull, because you know the hull may not be completely double, but the tank is separated from the outer skin of the vessel. And I guess, do we want to also say double hull? Different thing,
I think that covers it.
You think this covers it?
Yes, I think it does cover it because
it'd be non-contiguous in any case if it was a complete double hull. Okay. Okay, and that's definitely a something that would be a prevention, would prevent an oil spill. Okay, how about redundant propulsion systems?
Agreed.
How about redundant navigation systems?
This is Scott Carter. Would that be above, I guess, what the Coast Guard requirements presently would be?
Yeah, I don't think you require redundancy in navigation, do you?
Bill Huttmacher, I guess one of the things that I made mention on some of these when you got down to radars and things like that, in the navigation safety regulation, for certain size vessels, you do require more than one marine radar. Like the CSX, towed ships, all are required to have that.
So maybe for all of these, we'd have a qualifier if there are some that are already required, which go beyond existing required requirements. To get a prevention credit, you're going to go beyond what's already required by law or by regulation. How about bow thrusters on board the vessel? Does that qualify as a prevention measure?
Yeah, well, thrusters means more than one. Most ships just have one thruster, one bow thruster, if they have them at all.
Not sure, you know, from a prevention.
I was just
trying to determine how that would be
I don't think it prevents you from
maybe at the bottom of the list, I guess.
Well, if you lose if you lose steering, does this help you steer?
No.
It's going very slow.
You lose your thruster at over 3 knots.
Ah, okay.
So it's more like docking and things like that.
Yeah, thrusters are for docking.
Take it off?
Yeah.
Sure.
Where did that come from, Paul?
I think it came from us.
Yeah, we just went through this. I mean, you know, it's something that, you know, it's an aid to navigation. You know, I mean, aid to steering the vessel. But it might keep you from, you know, slamming into the dock and tearing a hole in the side of the ship. But that's the only thing that I could think of. Kept you from ramming the dock or something.
The ship, I'm thinking of much bigger ships, you know, and for me, it's a question of thrust that would be handy if your tugs were in an adequate distance at a terminal. I don't really see it as much of a prevention. I mean, I guess in theory you could say, but to me it's really an aid to docking and undocking the ship rather than a prevention.
Than navigating it, or
exactly. Yeah.
Are there many docking?
Yeah, that's a fairly risky operation. Well, I mean, you know, you're coming in contact with the not really much.
Cofield is very exciting.
So have we had incidents upon docking which created an oil spill?
Yes.
I've never had. No, how about if we keep it in, we move it way to the bottom of the list, and then we'll decide later whether it even qualifies. We're going to say this is marginal. We'll move it to the bottom of the list. Okay, use of an Alaska Marine pilot when not otherwise required by law.
You know that.
Yeah. John Bingham at the Coast Guard. Just curious, what case does that? When is a pilot not required right now?
Roll vessels, and certain vessels under tonnage.
Rolled vessels.
Just to provide a little more clarification.
For any ship, with the exception of Prince William Sound, any ship anywhere in the United States does not need a state licensed pilot if it's American registry enrolled,
right,
or under certain conditions of certain tonnage limits. And they vary from state to state. I think ours is 300 tons.
Okay, number 6, maintaining a transponder on board the vessel, which will indicate the vessel's location in Alaskan waters. And this was something, this came from something that Jeff and I have been working on, and we talked to Simon and some other people, like Jeff and O'Hara. Jeff, you want to kind of explain what we're talking about here?
Sure. Apologize for being late, by the way. Jeff Thompson here. The use of transponders was discussed earlier in terms of the Puget Sound Ring Exchange and the ITOS system they have in place there that is somewhat in place in Alaska. And the concept that's being developed here in Alaska is for the Alaska Marine Exchange, and that optionally a vessel that chose to have a transponder on board, indicating its position through radio VHF modems, basically, very cost-effective, much more cost-effective type of communication other than satellite, which a lot of the current AIS or automatic location systems currently use. And Paul and I in our discussions figure that a transponder, it's a prevention, of considerable merit when you can basically locate and identify vessels at any given moment, any given time. Now, a lot of people I've spoken to say, well, we know where our ship is. And they communicate regularly to us and give us indications as to their position. And that's all very true. But in a lot of vessel trades in Alaska, particularly in fisheries, I'm thinking of fisheries right now, Western Alaska, vessels will move around, tramp, if you will, to load fishery cargoes from American fishing vessels. I'm speaking specifically about small reefer vessels trading primarily export markets to Asia, Japan, and China, Korea. And the idea that in the instance, not so much from an enforcement point of view, but again from a prevention point of view, the idea of being able to track and monitor vessels, I think has some merit, particularly when it comes to a prevention credit.
Tom Reuter had his hand up in the back, and I'll go to you, Scott.
Tom Reuter with our sir. I wanted to bring up one point that over the last 10 years or so, tramper vessels, as Jeff is referring to, reefer trampers, were, to an extent, moving or appeared to be moving freely, although in the agents or the operators of them were fully aware of where they're at. This scenario has changed this year again, where when they enter into U.S. commerce, Customs takes action also to make sure that they're aware of where the vessel is proceeding from and proceeding to, whereas up until last year there were occasions when Customs offered kind of a blanket clearance that the vessel could pop from or drop from point to point without reporting each time where they went until after the fact. And that has changed
somewhat.
Scott? Scott Carter, I guess I'm a little bit unsure of how that could be a benefit to prevention without having a dedicated monitoring system, like the Coast Guard BTS systems, where if, say, the ship was noticed going near a reef line, or need to be notified or contacted, or just knowing where the ship is, I really don't see how it would be a prevention credit.
Yeah. Jeff Thompson. Scott, we're looking at there's software being developed where automatically a vessel that is a subscriber to the system could have navigational information bounced back to it, such as that. In other words, it emulates a what we know currently is a vessel traffic system, a VTS. But what we're looking at, again, this is just conceptual at this point, is the fact that known hazards to navigation could be placed in the system so that a vessel participating would have that information redundantly back to them. Exactly how that would work in terms of the software and the filtration and in terms of the confidentiality issues, which are very considerable, is still to be worked out. But potentially it has some of the best aspects of BTS available to us. But those, like I say, we're still identifying those.
Yes, ma'am.
This is the concept we're developing. We haven't identified exactly how that would work. But initially, what we're considering is yes, it basically a membership situation where vessels would have transponders aboard and would participate in the system voluntarily. This is pretty much the system that's in Puget Sound currently. We're not looking for mandatory compliance in this regard, just like we were looking at mandatory prevention measures like tow lines and pumps. But we think that such a system, it has other features which make it desirable from a commercial standpoint in terms of email and data capability and other very cost-effective communication modes. It doesn't really support, because it's not what's considered a real-time system, it's not what they call it, Captain, help me here, GMDSS, Global Marine Distress Safety System. It doesn't qualify for that qualification because it's what happens is the signals bounce around and go from transponder to transponder to relay station, and your communication is therefore delayed maybe as much as 5 minutes. But as far as a voluntary optional system that offers commercial features other than just knowing where the ship is, it's something that, again, we're looking at and seeing if there's any real interest in the industry for it.
So you'd pay a fee, and then transponder would cost about $1,000 to carry on the ship. If you're in a regular trade, you just install it on the ship. If you're a foreign vessel coming in, then it goes on with the, when the marine pilot goes on, or, you know, when they check into Dutch Harbor or whatever, and they carry it with them the whole time they're there. You know, it could be leased to them or whatever. But there is a financial cost to it.
If I could just add further clarification, what Paul's referring to is what Meteor Communications, who's the vendor for the Puget Sound system, called the pilot pack. And basically it's a pack the pilot himself carries that shows where the pilot is, which in some instances of Bristol Bay, when we have multiple movements and such during fishery seasons of herring and salmon, may be useful. Again, this is still, we're still examining this to see, you know, what the uses might be.
Hi, Bill Hubmacher. One thing, I think what Scott's saying is pretty important, though. I think unless you have some vessel-to-vessel capability that's built in as part of this, where you have, fine, you have a transponder showing where you are, but unless you have something that's feeding back where another transponder located equipped vessel is, it really doesn't do much with respect to prevention. It's good to know. It can give a general indicator. The only thing would be is if the transponder information was going back to some monitoring station in some regard. You know, we had something originally when some of the tankers from Valdez were exporting to the Far East. Part of the commerce export license required that they be monitored to make sure they didn't come within a certain distance of the Aleutians on their trip to the Far East. Well, the only reason something built up, whether it's either a shoreside monitor, or better yet, the information from your transponder is available to the guy on the other ship, then I think I agree with Scott that it would be hard to have this fall into the prevention category.
Exactly, Captain. Jeff Thompson again. The system does communicate transponder to transponder. The problem with anti-collision, what we're talking about is anti-collision features of such a system, is the lack of real-time information. That is, you know, to the second. But again, this is, you know, we're looking at this and seeing what the virtues are. It's emerging technology, and it just to me, just off on a very broad scope, you know, considering our 33,000 miles of coastline, the ability to identify and locate vessels in such a manner may have merit. But again, there's obviously a lot of other considerations that need to be applied before we can deploy such a system.
Charlotte?
Just considering that regulations don't always keep up with technology, if this is emerging and probably developing, maybe it's not there right now, but it can be written in such a way that if those deficiencies are, if you can have a system that does conquer those deficiencies, then it can count. And chances are the technology will catch up to the regulations.
And eventually you'll get to a system, and IMO is working on that standard now. Should have it within 5 or 10 years, maybe, is what they're looking at. But that'll be a real-time system. In the meantime, this works now, and it is affordable. So that's why it's kind of a transition into the long term.
I was just going to say, Parapilot, this is actually a lower, the marine exchange is actually a lower technology than what's already being tested now, is a thing called AIS, which has got problems, like Paul was saying, with the spectrum of bandwidth. But it's just a matter of time before I have an electronic chart. I can look at the electronic chart. I can see everybody in the Cook Inlet or wherever. So I'm not sure that we ought to say, what number is it?
Number 6.
It doesn't really specify a technology. It just specifies a goal.
That's right.
Yeah, so the marine exchange may or may not be the goal, maybe it's not be the technology.
Yes, certainly, but the concept of AIS, Captain, I think.
Yeah,
is
absolutely. Absolutely worthwhile.
So if any, if you carefully
craft it, okay, I got the notes on all that. Placement of mooring buoys in Alaska waters. This came up, Captain O'Hara raised this at the last meeting as could be a prevention measure where you've got, you know, you're not just counting on the ship's anchor. You've got a mooring buoy, and several ships go together to pay for a mooring buoy. They're expensive. They've got to be maintained. if they do that, go to that expense, do we want to consider that to be a prevention measure?
Ms. O'Hara, pilots. I brought this up in my association the other day, yesterday, and they were very concerned about the cost of the buoys, the engineering of the buoys, the insurance of the buoys, and the maintenance of the buoys. And so when I speak to this, I'm not representing Southwest Alaska Pilots. I'll just speak as a pilot. I think that the concept is valid. It's a good concept, but it's got a lot of problems. And again, who's going to determine who uses the buoys? Who's going to say some ships will, some ships won't? If I do it, am I doing this because I want a tugboat that's going to have to take lines to the buoy? You know, there's just so many problems involved in that I'm going to let somebody else collect the wisdom join on this.
But Mike, didn't we in Dutch Harbor, private companies went and put their own mooring
buoy? Crowley has a mooring buoy in Dutch Harbor, and I don't know if they rent it out or how they handle it.
So, yes?
Paul, Bill Huttmacher. The Unalaska is definitely one. The city of Unalaska is very progressive in looking at this mooring buoy issue, and various companies have been looking at it. But you're right, Captain O'Hara, when you say that the proper engineering of these buoys and the maintenance, continuing maintenance of it, are big issues, and it is big money. But it certainly can be done, and it might be something that should be considered in these areas where we know we have severe weather to deal with on a routine basis. The Aleutians being a perfect example.
Right.
A Fognak Island, another.
Well, Fognak, they do have O'Hara pilots. They do have mooring buoys in Fognak. My association told me to inform this group that they intend to anchor ships farther away from the spit, so that a mooring buoy won't be used more. They get them farther away from the spit, so you got more time to react. You got shallower water, less chance of dragging. So that's as president of Southwest Pilots.
All right. I guess the question I wonder about here is, the mooring buoy is attached to the bottom of the ocean, not to the ship. So I guess the question is, how do you attach a mooring buoy as a credit to a vessel?
Because who pays to put it in and maintain it?
Well, but is the vessel only going to moor in that one place in all the state's waters?
No, but I mean, if it's there, if you're going to Dutch all the time and you got a mooring buoy, you're going to be less likely to have an accident. And that's why
I think that might be, Bill Huttmacher again, that might be very applicable to a place like, especially like the Aleutians, where the reefers are going to these designated spots and the fishing vessels are coming to them. So that might be something as opposed to other ships that transit throughout.
Ms. O'Hara, in Dutch Harbor there are severe weather restrictions. A ship at a buoy may or may not have to go to sea, because the anchor is not as reliable as a mooring buoy. So there might be an incentive for a company to put a mooring buoy in so they won't have to fire up the plant and go out and do potential damage to their ship in the middle of a gale. So there's a possibility with that.
Cynthia, then Scott.
Charlotte.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Another thing where this may be more practical is if we do move into fleet plans,
there's
a whole fleet utilizing an area, and the credit is going towards that fleet management.
Scott? Scott Farner, I didn't really see it on the list, but it's probably in line with this topic, is maybe the size and type of anchor gear that they have on board the ship is being maybe a more reasonable.
So it could be another approach, but I don't think there's any question that it is a prevention item. I think if we write it just in general terms like this, we're not saying how it gets put there or who pays for it, but if it goes in, you know somebody's going to pay for it. You know, it's not going to be cheap to put a mooring buoy in. If they go to that point to do it, increase their safety, they ought to get a credit for it. Scott?
We talk about a lot of money. I don't know this money. Is there Do we have a cost associated? Is there any kind of...
Yeah.
The issue of mooring buoys in Unalaska Dutch Harbor is a long one. When I was the port director there in 1992, we had P&D do an order of magnitude engineering on both a 3- and a 5-star mooring buoy. Liability is also an issue, is whoever does own the buoy or whoever puts it in is then subject to liability if there's a failure of that buoy. But that aside, at that time, we were looking at $1.5 million for a buoy, and then extrapolating the amount of revenue we could get for renting a buoy instead of anchoring, it didn't pencil out. Now, of course, the severe weather guidelines, we've revisited the issue in Dutch, and that, of course, the rates have gone up, as has the price of the buoy for installation and, of course, ongoing maintenance. And in certain instances out there where the companies that utilize Unalaska Dutch Harbor as a port would be interested in that, a buoy enables a spot in the harbor that may not be available otherwise because of a couple of reasons. Exposure, as we've determined, in terms of winds during the winter months, or depth, that the scope of anchor the depth is too great to allow, therefore the scope of anchor, 5-to-1, 7-to-1, whatever is appropriate, would allow too great a swing, where a buoy then cuts that down and does allow mooring to take place in that area that couldn't be used otherwise. But they're at this point, Scott, to put in a C-type buoy on a three-star system that would be very secure for a certain, say, a 20,000-ton vessel, I'd say you're probably looking between $2 and $3 million per, just as a rough guesstimate. That's a lot of money.
So can we list it as a prevention measure then, if people go to that expense for the extra safety?
Well, Paul, if I may continue.
No.
For example, Northland has a buoy in Dutch, as does, of course, Crowley, and they use them. And I think it would be a matter of, again, the co-ops looking at it and saying, well, we're tying our barge or our vessels up to this buoy, and having that, if it's listed as a potential credit, I think that's appropriate. No matter, like you say, it doesn't really matter who puts it in. And there are buoys existing that are being used. There's no doubt where the buoy is off of APL there in Dutch Harbor, where Northland uses it. It's in a very tough spot to anchor, but it's in a very appropriate spot for a buoy. So I think anything you can do to encourage the use of buoys should happen.
Okay, then. Moving on to use of advanced or redundant radar or vessel collision avoidance systems beyond what's required in the regulations. What do people think of this as a prevention measure?
What's the difference between that and number three with the navigation systems? Sounds to me as
the part.
I guess you could just combine those two. You just scratch number two and combine them with this. Is this realistic, Scott?
Question on the advanced, because as the advanced goes on, there's going to be bigger, better, more than what there is today. And I don't know if they're determined who has advanced and who doesn't.
Best available technology.
That's never
touched. You're even going to find that one? Well, good. Eric Britton, this goes back to what Paul was talking about, above and beyond what's required.
Yeah, that's the standard. Okay, how about number nine, use of routes which avoid shorelines and environmentally sensitive areas? I think this is something that Larry brought up or was a part of that discussion. I mean, if you're going to, say you're going to Red Dog and you agree you're going to stay off shore of any land during your entire transit in there, park the ship and take your cargo and go, should there be a credit for that, for using a route which avoids land? This is something that the Coast Guard looked at some of these as far as some of the vessels, how far offshore you are, and things like that.
At Monera, actually, we've spoken about this before a few times, at least for Cook Inlet and other areas of Alaska, but I think there's really pros and cons to having those routes there.
Yeah, well, speaking of Red Dog, I used to pilot up there, and I don't know what it's like now since the breakup of the Soviet Union, but we had to stay close to Cape Prince of Wales because we were worried about getting shot. I don't know if that's still appropriate. So, another thing to consider is weather. You start talking about being so far offshore, you get out of the lee of the land. I think that the master of the ship should have the responsibility to choose the best route for his ship. And he's not going to, he doesn't want to put his ship in danger, either on the beach or weather-wise or anyplace else. That's the prerogative of the master of the ship.
Yes.
Well, Bill Huttmacher, one of the things I think, I look at the type of things we say to avoid shorelines in environmentally sensitive areas. I think unless the state or the resource agency is someone that we've gone out and we've identified specifically environmentally sensitive areas that we want mariners to avoid, you know, then this is hard to come by. I guess I look at it sort of, we have areas right now like that are more on the, that they've identified like sea lion rookery or other areas that we specifically told vessels we don't want them to get in the of that because they're going to somehow endanger or harass or disturb the wildlife. Until we've come up with something that says help someone, a company or whoever, identify what an environmentally sensitive area is, or we've listed them, it would be hard to meet this.
No, they have been listed and have been mapped, and we had that at our previous meeting that was given up.
Was that something specifically that was set up?
Yeah. And they're called mesas. So those are identified, and that's
okay,
just
so
what
that's
I referred to. Yeah, and I don't know if it's legitimate, but people raised it, so I put it down here as an idea of routes or avoiding environmentally sensitive areas.
Is that something that's being done right now, though? They're already doing it?
Yes. That's Larry Dietrich of DEC. Yes, the vessel routing issue, we had a pretty good discussion on how many were at the response planning standard work group, but it came up there because it's a technique can be used to avoid having to get a contingency plan. For example, if the vessels, particularly the fishing vessels, stay outside state waters, you can totally avoid these requirements. In Monterey Bay on California now, they have prescribed distances that have to be maintained offshore for vessels. Monterey Bay is a critical habitat maritime area, and the vessel routing there, they push them 12 miles off, 15 miles, and it's a north-south thing combined with a distance offshore that's necessary to provide the reaction time to go out and provide the assistance, coupled with a distance that's also sufficient to launch a response to be able to maintain control oil, keep them from coming on shore. So, and I think, well, Simon's here, but the TAPS crew tanker trade in Alaska goes 200 miles offshore now to not only completely avoid the state requirements, but they can also avoid the federal requirements. And is that good or bad? Well, from a state perspective, staying outside 3 miles is incredibly beneficial. It prevents casualties. It prevents. It does provide additional reaction time, and it does. Provide the opportunity to contain control a little bit better. So it's probably one of the cheapest and most powerful tools in the toolbox here. Now, do we have to be prescriptive about it? Well, not necessarily, but certainly ultimately the captain in every case is responsible for where he goes, but certainly if they set up routes and patterns that avoid state waters, it's good. I don't know if it's how it fits into prevention, but it definitely can avoid a lot of problems.
We've got two summary maps. All the detailed maps of the 76 most environmentally sensitive areas are on the website today for this task force, so that anybody who wants to take a look at what they are available.
Could you give the website address for everybody again so they know how to look it up?
Off the top of my head, no. But it is in each of the email notices of meeting, and there'll be an email agenda going out tonight for Wednesday's meeting, and it'll be contained in there.
Go ahead, Bill.
Just a question on that, and I apologize for not being part of this and being aware of this specifically, but one jumps out at me here. Kachemak Bay is listed. The pilot, to pick up a pilot, the state designated pilot pickup point is in Kachemak Bay. So there's no way under state law that someone could avoid this area. It's just one that jumps out to me. And then the other one I was just wondering about on this is, was it discussed of to avoid these areas, how far do you need to be away from them? I mean, is it outside of state 3 miles away, or? I'm just curious what that was.
This is Larry Dietrich. Yeah, well, the discussion the other day was, again, with response to the response planning standard. And so that was discussed in the context of 3 miles, and the 3 mile being the state water limits of state waters. And so if you lease state out beyond 3 miles, then you're not even subject to whatever the state has.
Here's the website address, Eric, really had it on the document.
Yeah, right. It may not work in every area. I mean, I'm sure there's areas particularly, the biggest exception to the rule here on flexibility and vessel routes and where you could go and where you could change. The greatest opportunity to capitalize on moving offshore a little bit probably might be along the Aleutians if you're not fishing inside 3 miles. But then southeast Alaska is probably the most restrictive, and it's the ability to, for cruise ships, for example, to adjust their routes within the inside of Aussie just doesn't exist.
Bill,
so.
In fact, also Susan Harvey-DC has responded to that. It's acknowledged that when you come into the port, obviously, to make a delivery or a pickup, you're going to have to cross the state waters. I think what Larry was mentioning is that when you're transiting from one port to the other, if you could pick a route that could get you offshore further, not impact the environmental, that would be the best. And these are the list of mesas that you're used to from the sub-area plan. So.
So can we leave this in? I mean, it seems like it is a tool. We don't have all the specifics nailed down yet. And, of course, we haven't talked about implementation of these. And for all of these, I mean, the department is going to have to be the one that says, you run a checklist and said, okay, we're going to certify that, you know, you meet this certain criteria for a rating. And then later on, we're going to get into inspection here for how, if you claim you've got something on board, that the department have a right to verify that, in fact, you had that. Did you have something, Heather, in the
I do. This is Heather McCarty. I guess to look at the environmentally sensitive areas and realize how they overlap with operations areas of fisheries, if you were in that position, you would obviously have a little bell going off in your head right now, which would prevent you from agreeing to this. Because if you make it advisable and preferable not to operate in the areas where you already operate and always will operate, you're sort of cutting off your nose. So I guess I'd have to sort of disagree with that one as being sort of something that was looked upon as being good. Because, yes, it's good to avoid them when you're in transit and when you don't have to be in there. But if you conduct your business in those areas, which is the case in many of these areas for the fishing fleet, I just can't agree that that would be something that would be, that I could say, yes, we should be not in there, because obviously we have to be, so, in some cases.
Well, I was just, Bill Hutmacher, I was just going to say, Heather, on that, and maybe I'm not doing it right, but I think what we're looking at here is that this could be something that if you did this would result in a yet-to-be-determined credit.
Right.
And
right, but one that we can never attain.
That's correct. But it could be that just if you're in this area because of operations, then you have to meet all the requirements. It's just not a place where you can, if your business goes there, you can't get a credit for that.
The other possibility is if we weight these and come out with a list, let's say we end up with 10 of them and we say, okay, if you meet 7 of them or whatever, then you get the Ruby Ship designation. And, you know, so I don't think it has to be all or nothing. In your five-star program, do they have to meet every single criteria?
Yeah.
You also have a weighted or a
1 to 5.
They can achieve 1. John Bingham and Coast Guard, they can achieve 1 to 5 stars. And to get to the 5 stars, they have to meet all of the criteria. but they can choose to meet a different star level.
Okay. Cheryl?
A couple of things. One, in reaction to that, I think we need to be very careful. And if there is a five-star test program, it should just be the kind of industry standard. And anything else you do is above and beyond credit of some sort. Because otherwise, it doesn't add a punitive thing. It can go from there and become five-star.
Never.
Routine is fairly cut dried. We have a certain tracks as sea land, and the regular traders have certain tracks. But if the master of the ship or the pilot decide that for the purposes of safety, they should deviate from that track. Then, and they may have to deviate to someplace that's within 3 miles of something or another. Then that should be a prerogative for safety. I think that if you regulate something into being unsafe or whatever this thing, if this would be a vote, I would vote no.
And then kind of if that was the case, then I would be concerned you get something distracting people from making the safest decision because there's some other
step that
they're taking.
Go ahead, Eric.
Eric, but just a quick point. Going back to the discussion that Heather was initiating, about. How are we going to score this? I think at this point we're not really concerned about how we can score it. I mean, we have things on here like thrusters. We have things on here like mooring buoys. If you have a ship that never goes anywhere where there's a mooring buoy, you're not eligible for that credit either. So maybe what we want to do is just create the list, and then when we further develop it, by all means, let's write down our notes on these. Then we can discuss how applicable they are depending upon how we want to apply them.
Good. Larry?
Yeah, Larry Dietrich, DC. Yeah, I think we don't want to, I'm be concerned about leaving these, taking these off now because the scoring system here, okay, I doubt, to me it's not necessarily, there may not be any boat that's going to be able to meet all 5, 10, or whatever we end up with here. So the scoring system to me is going to be structured some other way. It's going to be like 20 points. Okay, and then, because I don't see boats going out putting bow thrusters on when this comes online. So I think the way we build the scoring system is more germane to what we're doing here. And if it's 20 points and you got 20 different ways then of attaining the 20 points, it's whether what you got to do 20 points. And any one vessel might pick 3 out of the 5 or whatever to get to 20 points and get the groovy ship plaque. Or
right.
There's a lot of ways to approach it, I think.
I can see this groovy ship plaque.
And that's the other thing. We got to keep in mind here, again, we're on the recommended column here. None of these are mandatory if I understand what we're doing.
I have a question, too. At the beginning of the day, we said it's 20% equipment and 80% human, and we've been focusing on the 20%, haven't we?
Oh, yeah.
There are also items that are more in our purview to actually designate. Human factors. Are we going to go in and set how many hours a day you can work on a vessel?
Or
at least for tankers.
I guess the question I would ask the group is, are there any prevention measures that deal with that aren't already in the rules that would be over and above the existing rules that get at, when you were talking 80% of casualties, 90% of the spills, all came on that human side, and the pilots, I think, is the primary one we've got here that addresses that.
Go ahead, Susan.
I wrote down, too, that we had chatted about this morning, which was vetting program, which goes into a lot of training and qualifications.
the other one was, I think Mike brought up, was bridge resource management or additional specialized training that might go above and beyond what they're required to do by federal regulation.
Yeah, go ahead. If you could give us an a little more general, besides her specific question, what are the areas of the human side of this thing that you feel we would be legally or practically could get involved in?
Well, I think the main thing I wanted to add, and again, this has to do with maybe not what's required specifically right at this moment, but what is coming in the future. Right now, the tankers and passenger ships have to meet the International Safety Management Code. They have to show that they've developed all these systems, they've looked at everything, which talks about all types of things, in terms of human factors, how they operate their ships, everything involved. And that has to be certified by the flag state, put up a flag. That's going to come into effect for all of the ships, freight ships, all the other ships, in July of 2002. They're going to have to meet all of these same requirements. So a lot of those human factor issues are going to be addressed at that point, too.
Well,
or have to be. It doesn't mean that you can't look at some now, but those are going to be addressed then, by then. Some have already met that. Some of the ships that are operating out there currently meet the ISM code requirements, and they don't have to.
They did that voluntarily.
They've
and who's,
that
who
voluntarily.
Certified that they had met them?
The flag states.
Okay, so maybe that's one. As if before, if you go for the system
yeah,
before July of 2002.
That might be worth it. Because that's something they've done over and above what's required.
Right.
Jim, you raised one earlier as well, the Membership and Citizens Advisory Council.
I was almost got to that.
Oh, okay.
This way, we're going on down the list. Heather, we got something else, sir?
No, I would like to speak to the Citizens Advisory Council issue.
Okay, if you want to. And then we also, someone had mentioned TUG somewhere along the line here, too, so let's not forget the general issue of use of tugboats or whatever. Somebody had raised. So did you want to talk to this, Jim? Let's let Jim talk to it before we ask for comments if we've got it on the table.
Thanks, Paul. I think the way I'd like to start this out is that, you know, after the Exxon Valdez spill, Mikowski went back and incorporated into the Open 90 a section about establishing these two citizens groups, one in Prince William Sound and one in Cook Inlet. And one of the reasons behind all of that was to create an atmosphere of prevention. And of course that's part and response is another and so on. And over the past 10 years we've done many a study that's reflects our interest in prevention, and they're on the web. But I have about six things that I'd like to just kind of read off to you, the things that we've been involved in. One is developing a risk assessment for the navigation system for Kennet. We had a forum down in Homer. We had about 120 people. People from the Congressional Office, State Legislature, DEC, non-tanker and tanker folks served on the panels. And it was a very knowledgeable affair that occurred. And what our whole purpose of that was putting a tug, trying to get the interest in putting a tug down in the Homer area for prevention purposes. And Senator Pierce sort of led the discussion about doing a risk assessment for Cook Inlet. And so the consensus after that was that we do a risk assessment. These are the kind of things that we get to be a part of and help generate that kind of interest. We've contributed to safe navigation aids and systems, updated charts, weather reporting stations, channel markers. We've been involved in the study of human factors. We have reviewed and comment on the prevention plans of the crude oil tankers. We've consistent voice for oil spill prevention before the state and before congressional committees. And the list goes on. I think what's really important is that the stakeholders need to know what's going on and what's involved. Especially, I can guarantee you that the seven mayors that are on our council and six other special interest groups are extremely aware of our organization and the activities that we're involved in. On a response side of things, we go to the command center. We're part of the system. We get to notify the communities what's happening. We're in the process of developing a trajectory computer model that can follow oil spills and when they're going to hit the shores and what effect it's going to have and the ability to communicate in the communities. There are numerous other things that that I could go into, but my main point is somehow involve the stakeholders, somehow involve the communities in this activity. I would personally, once that, and if this becomes law, and the folks know what we do in reference to crude oil tankers and the facilities. This is law, and if, pray God, there isn't ever a problem, and we don't, you know, they don't get all of the history, they don't get all the information, there's going to be a lot of doubt in people's mind about why this is not happening in those cases too. And so whether it's RCACs or port authorities or whatever, port safety committees, I mean, regardless. But what I'm trying to say to this group, I think you really need something that involves the citizen stakeholders up and down the coast. I'll just terminator there.
Heather?
Yes, this is Heather McCarty, and I guess what you just said is slightly different than what you originally said. I was thinking that you were talking about lumping the non-tank vessel operators in with the tank vessel operators in this, in these existing groups, which I think would be a bad idea for a number of reasons. One is that there's an awful lot of politics involved and other things that, that really don't apply to the non-tank vessel operators, I don't think. And I would hate to see them in the same group. And I also wonder a little bit about the practicality of how people would be included in the membership of those groups and so forth. But in terms of a stakeholder group, I don't have any problem with that. I just was worried about the actual existing groups being expanded to include us. I think that would be very difficult and inadvisable.
Charlotte McKay, somewhat in agreement with that, of course, is that I think stakeholder involvement is important, but I don't think we should prescribe exactly how it's set up. For us, we already have the system committee that we have to do and want to do, but I mean, it would start becoming consecutive to have a supervisory council without a certain structure. So there should be recognition of stakeholder involvement, but not necessarily mandating a structure on that side.
Brian just mentioned to me something here, and Leather, you could go that way, or you could also identify some of the work products that might take place with this. For instance, if you participate in a risk assessment evaluation of your operations, then maybe that should count for something.
Yeah.
Scott?
I'd like to echo Heather and Charles' concerns, but the Coast Guard is currently planning up or gearing up a new certificate for that risk assessment. There's several stakeholders and groups that are involved in that. I think there's already a good set of members that, I mean, this is work that is ongoing, and everybody knows that you can go above and beyond having another risk assessment, or this is, Eric?
I'm not sure that this is the proper point in our agenda to talk about, but one thing many of us have been talking about off and on is recognizing the fact that in other locations there are regional marine safety committees, groups, organizations, whatever, that perhaps spring out of as a result of legislative acts, you know, or whatever, where the industry and to some extent the stakeholders opt more towards self-regulation with, you know, with the agreement, you know, of the regulating bodies that, you know, that they're associated with. And there seems to be a lot of interest in, is that where the task force can go, or does at least the idea come out of the task force, you know, that maybe we have such an organization? And then getting back into what we're talking about here, you know, it's like, so what would membership do for you? Well, of course, then it's what does this safety group, organization, committee, or whatever do? And if they're materially involved in improving, you know, the safety of vessels, the safety of navigation, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to the point where it really is demonstrably a benefit, you know, maybe it could tie back in, you know, to a credit. But it's two things I'm thinking about here. One is kind of like, you know, where do we go from here when this is all over and done with? But it also, I think, addresses some of the things, sort of an idea that Jim was espousing.
Mike?
No.
Jeff?
Yeah, just to clarify, the risk assessment that's going to be done by the Coast Guard, that may be the answer. Is this
also
part of the marine transportation system? Analysis?
It ties into that, John Bingaman. It's called PALSA, Ports and Waterways Safety Assessment. And it looks at a specific body of water and assesses the risk associated with navigating that body.
And if I may continue, Jim, the risk assessment being that came out of our meeting last fall, is what's the progress report on that, please?
It's sort of on hold until after the Coast Guard project.
They're not the same project.
No.
Thank you. Did you have something additional? Go ahead.
John Bingaman again. The Coast Guard is presently on a national basis looking at harbor safety committees is the term. Presently, there are several different bodies within the state of Alaska that focus on specific issues. And our vision is to have these harbor safety committees established in certain regions or zones where it makes the most sense to have them due to the shipping or what have you. So we're stepping in that direction, and it may be that if companies participate on the harbor safety committee, it might be something to consider as far as giving them credit or not. But it's still yet to be determined. It might be a little premature to state that at this point. But.
Okay, yes, Simon?
Simon Shetsky. I just was wondering how this could be tied into a credit for a ship operator. It seems to be difficult that maybe, you know, if you contributed to a harbor safety committee description or something like that, or you'd get some kind of a credit. I don't know practically how it could. I see difficulties in this one.
Anybody else? Well, what's the will of the group on this one? We did, you know, discussion all around the issue.
Pat describes just what Simon was aware of. That's Pat, would you care to respond to Simon's
Jim.
Oh. I'll
look
at work.
Look, Pat Carter, too, or was that
Carter,
the
guy? That's my group.
My son, yeah. Insofar as credits are concerned, that would be one way of providing support for those kinds of organizations. I know we're coming up to another subject here, I think. What are the costs and so on? You know, another good area to deal with that as well.
But we want to say if it is, if you're a membership of a port committee or a CETA Citizens Advisory Commission or something that deals with marine safety issues, we want to have that as one of the points of evaluating whether people have met the five-star program or the, whatever we're going to call it. Scott?
Okay. I think that's been really difficult to last over there. What is the, you know, we have the Nikiski Marine Thermal Safety Committee that we have, but is that a recognized committee? Is it a, do we have to have a certain agenda or topics discussed in order to our attendance? I mean, it's getting pretty big, I think, to really focus on it.
Bill?
Bill Huttmacher, I'd like to address that, too. I think with respect to these various committees that we have already set up around, like Scott mentioned, we have very effective Nikiski Terminal Safety, our Terminal Operator Safety Committee, the Dutch Harbor Casualty Prevention Work Group, the group we're starting in ADAC, the group in Kodiak that we do. I guess I view those as, I don't know that that would be a good thing to say you get credit for participating, because in most of those, I'm driving the issue, and I'm pretty much telling people, you know, we're going to be doing these type of things, and you need to be participating. So it's not really a, I guess you could say it's voluntary, but they sort of look at it as, they sort of look at it as, well, no, Huttmacher's going to do something, so I'd rather be part of the process.
Yeah.
And so I think it would be, it's not, I'd have a hard time characterizing it as voluntary.
Coast Guard voluntary as opposed to voluntary.
Well, you know, they certainly get a benefit out of it because their credit, I guess the credit in this one is that I've let it go as they come up with the solution that's right for them that meets my concerns. So that's the credit they get out of it. So, but I don't know about giving credit for this type of thing because I think they're going to participate anyway.
Charlotte, I think you're
going to pass it.
Okay, Eric?
In response to what Captain Huttmacher says, I think when it comes to credits, he's exactly right. You know, if we had a very specific organization that had a very specific program that we felt was directly applicable and did affect safety materially, particularly for a large number of operators and classes, I think we could go there. I think it's a great concept, but, yeah, it's probably pretty nebulous at this point as far as a credit goes.
Heather?
This is Heather McCarty. Yeah, I agree. I think it's a great concept. But I think, again, with this one, we have to examine whether it's attainable by everyone or available to everyone. In some of these cases, clearly, if you operated in Nikiski or wherever, you could attain that point or it was available to you. In the case of any of the existing RCAC situations, if I'm not mistaken, those are designated seats, are they not? And aren't they appointed by various people?
The law requires it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you weren't appointed to one of those seats, then you couldn't attain that check mark, and therefore it would be unavailable to you. I mean, that's just a point, generally speaking. These should be things that are potentially...